Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Jimmy Dean. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm
glad to be here. Well, at least until 5 or 10 minutes ago, I was glad to be here. I am from Dallas, Texas. I'm from the Chicago group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Dallas, Texas. If you're ever in Dallas, we're in person only. 7 o'clock on a Wednesday night. I think it's the best speaker meeting in my state. 21 years ago, and a little bit of change, 6 or 7 of us were sitting around in my sponsor's breakfast room thinking about forming a new group. I came with an agenda, which wouldn't surprise anybody that had ever been in an AA business meeting with me before or since. I wanted to name the group Suburban. That was an ancient group in Dallas. It was long gone, but you know, all those people have been sober since the earth cooled. The roots were in the Suburban. And so we had this format that had been slid to us by a guy in Chicago, Illinois. And they meet at 7 o'clock Central Time on Wednesday for a 90-minute speaker meeting. And the name of the group inside the loop in Chicago was the California Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we adopted the format and we said, well, if they did it up there and called themselves the California Group, we're in Dallas, we might as well just call ourselves the Chicago Group. And we had a couple that got sober with us a few years ago. He went to medical school in San Antonio, Texas. Maybe you went for the International Convention in San Antonio. And about a year into his term down there in school, they started a meeting, 7 o'clock on Wednesday night. You go to the Dallas Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in San Antonio, Texas. We give sobriety dates in my part of the world. I've certainly heard you give some over the weekend. I know that's probably not the custom. Old guy named Dave Day, he's long in the big meeting, but I listened to those old-timers when I got sober, and David said, you know, a lot of times after they've heard you talk for about 5 or 10 minutes, if you don't give a sobriety date, they might think you don't have one. And so I do. It's the 25th of August, 1997, and I'm thankful for that. I've been on a lot of committees. I've been involved in a lot of stuff, and I want to tell you, this is a well-oiled machine. And so I thank each and every one of you who've had any hand at all in making sure that this event came to fruition. 37 years. I am only 26 years in this deal, and I'm going to tell you, I don't take any of this stuff for granted. I don't think that Alcoholics Anonymous moves by self-propulsion. I know that we are certainly a spiritual organization, not a material organization, but one of the greatest opportunities for me is the sponsor looked at me and said, Jimmy, if you'll just look outwardly rather than inwardly, your life will begin to change. And I could not absorb or comprehend what that meant at the time. But I can tell you today, just a little bit on the flip side of that deal, if we look outwardly rather than inwardly, our lives begin to drastically change. I want to thank June and Mark for, well, they gave me a car. You know, I mean, okay, they've been sober a long time, and I'm thinking, they're like, we're just going to give you a car. And I was like, okay. And anybody and everybody got anything to do with any of it. From the basket, from the greetings, from the whole deal. I've been in Southern California since Wednesday. I'm still debating whether or not I want to get on that plane in LAX this afternoon. I like it that you can open your windows in April. We can't do that in Dallas. We have no idea what that is. And I'm a guy who's cleverly disguised as a functioning member of society because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it's debatable about the selection of me on the program for Sunday morning, but we're just going to run with that because that's where we find ourselves, right? I know that I did not know or understand the power greater than myself when I came. I know that during the course of the long, hot summer of 1997, when I couldn't draw a sober breath, I really was in the middle of a group of people who absolutely believed that God, as they understood God, was doing for them what they could not do for themselves. They showed me that in the actions that they took. It wasn't so much about giving lip service as much as it was that they were taking selfless action. And so I understand that book, our book, says that its main object is to help somebody like me find a power greater than myself which will solve my problem. And I can tell you this morning that when I reconciled with that power that I know to be certainly greater than me, this morning I realized that God certainly has, is, and will continue to do things for me that in and of myself I have absolutely no power to do. Now, what I believe in my experience is the exact same thing is happening for you. We are people who would not ever mix. Long time ago, I heard about Jack Alexander. Lots of us know about Jack Alexander. He's the guy who blew the lid off this thing called AA. The book, April, this month, 85 years ago, they ran that printer's copy of the manuscript, the one that Hazelden made into a coffee table book, right? Just beaten all up. Ruth Hawks said, I will not type that one more time, right? I am not typing that again. And so they went up there really on a ruse. Let's just say that brutal honesty was not part of the program in 1939. And so there were five or six of them went up there and took that manuscript up to Cornwall Press to run 5,000 copies of the book. And among all of them, Bill Wilson, Dorothy Snyder, Ruth, of course, they drug her up there. She wasn't a member of AA, but she was the long-suffering, quote-unquote, secretary of our fledgling organization. And they stayed in a little motor court the night before, and they didn't have enough money for the motor court. They had to call Charlie Towns, who had dried Bill out however many times, to get the money to pay for the motel so they could hand off that manuscript that next day. So here we come along, you know, we're expecting that this thing is going to light up like wildfire. It doesn't happen, right? As Dr. Bob would say, it did not gel. Nobody knew about AA. So here comes old Jack Alexander. And what I did not know from those archivists and historians that make such wonderful presentations for us, you know, those people, there's a guy in my home group, and you know, anything's got Mayflower or anything on it, he buys it. And then you go to his house and he'll show you something like a church key, you know, like a bottle opener says Mayflower Hotel. And he'll go, I bet Bill used that to open a Coke at the Mayflower Hotel. And he's a little off. Before he got to AA, he thought he controlled planets and stuff. And I don't think all that's gone yet, right? But anyway, we had that little clubhouse in New York. And that fledgling Western deal in Akron, right? That's all that we had. Jack was an investigative reporter. You know what we were telling people back then? We said, one alcoholic sharing experience, strength, and hope with another alcoholic, both of them get better. And even more powerful than that, we said, we don't charge anything for that. And Jack knew that was bullcorn. And he was coming so he could expose us for the Ponzi scheme that he was sure that we were. That's the real deal. It's not in the article, the pamphlet that's in the article. That's our piece of our literature. So Jack didn't come kind of like medical students come to certain groups in my town. You know, oh my gosh, the medical students are coming. Put on underwear, right? The medical students are coming. I mean, we didn't have any advance information that this guy was coming, was going to write something about AA. We just acted like all of you have acted during the course of this weekend in every experience that I've had. Our department shouted that we had an answer to a non-alcoholic. So we came 15 or 20 minutes before the meeting started. And he asked me at the coffee bar, why are you here? Are you staying? Are you going? What's your deal? What's going on? And you told him whatever you could about your story. And then he listened to a lead, 15 or 20 minutes. Dr. Bob said anything over 20 minutes was ego. So you made a 15 or a 20 minute talk, and maybe they discussed a little bit after that. After that was over, they had the meeting after the meeting, such as it was, and Jack interviewed a few other people again. And he maybe did that, I think, maybe two or three times. And then he went home and he wrote the article that blew the lid off Alcoholics Anonymous. The Saturday Evening Post, which for those of you who don't really know anything about printed magazines, it was Facebook in 1941. So in my own home group, that 21-year Wednesday night 90-minute speaker meeting deal, after I got the full story about the details that were kind of, you know, the underpinning of the real attraction of Alcoholics Anonymous, I made coffee at my home group. I came off the General Service Board a year ago, April, and my sponsor got me the job to make coffee in my home group. I've been the interim chair of the General Service Board, so if you weren't praying for AA before today, you need to start praying for AA. And so my sponsor, when I got home, he said, you know what, you spent 4 years doing stuff to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's about time you did something for Alcoholics Anonymous. He made me the coffee guy. So I show up at 5:30 and I open the fellowship hall at the church where we meet. People start coming in for early commitment, 6:15, 6:30. Not every single week, but maybe once every couple of months. I stand over there in the corner of the room, and I just listen. Twos and threes and fives and sevens of us interacting with one another. You hear that crew chief putting up those chairs, and you know you've got a guy that you've been trying to put salt on his tail. He's been sober about 24 hours, 24 days. He's moving those chairs as best as he possibly can. He's wondering what in the world this has to do with staying sober one day at a time. And the guy that's got some time, who's moving all the chairs in before they place them out, he's showing them how they line all that stuff up and trying to keep them spaced so people have just enough room for comfort. And as he's telling that guy that, I hear that guy share something intimate that he's never told another human being. Because there's some comfort in doing that work with somebody else that tells him that it's okay to begin to have a discussion that perhaps outside of that building would frighten him, would put him in a place where he would feel like he was vulnerable. And the vulnerability begins to go away in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. He begins to exhibit pride of place, not pride, but pride of place. He knows he's among equals. He's with his folks. He's with his people. So then we sit down and we listen to whoever comes over from another group or across town to share their story, experience, strength, and hope. And I close my eyes again and I listen. 5 or 10 minutes. Clarity, hopefully, better than what you're getting this morning. Clarity of a message. What I was like, what happened, what I'm like today as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Then as we're cleaning up that room and dumping everything out, and talking about where we're going to go to dinner, coffee, pie, whatever's going to happen, one more time I stand out of the corner and I look at those people, some faces I know, some I don't, and I listen to their interchanges again. A lot of times, you know, we're saying, we'll only be gone for an hour, right? We just want to get the new guy or gal in the car, right? If we just get them in the car, and my barometer, my acid test, for lack of a better term, just for me as a member of that home group, is I ask myself, this is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, just like this today is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. If Jack Alexander had been in here tonight, he was going home to write an article about AA, what would he write? What would be his article? What would he say? So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous 32 years of age. I was dying of alcoholism. I did not know or think that I was alcoholic when I came to AA. I'd been raised in a good home. It just didn't stay stable. Happens to a lot of us, right? I've heard some of those stories over the course of the weekend. My mother was a South Louisiana girl, so if you think this accent's bad, you have absolutely no idea. She turned coffee into a 9-syllable word. From an ancient family down there, come to Dallas, go to school at SMU. They thought she was certifiably insane to come to Texas for higher education. My dad was pretending to be a professor at Southern Methodist University. He didn't have any credentials. He had some degrees. We were small town enough then in the late 50s, early 60s, they let him stand in front of a geology class and pretend like he knew how to instruct somebody about something. And my mother was an art history major. I think she wanted to get married. And she was impressed by this professor. And that's how it all started. So way back then, in the dark ages, the way they did it is she had another year of school. He waited for her. And then they engaged to be married and stayed engaged the whole year. And then they got married and stayed married a whole year before she got pregnant and had me. And I sponsor 11 or 12 guys now, and I tell you, that is a newsflash to those guys, right? They think that is just completely and totally opposite. Not all of them young, but some of them young guys. A guy named Mike that I sponsor, and he was secretary of our meeting. I was really proud of Mike. He's done well. He's sober now 12, 13 years, but he got sober young, like a bunch of you did. And so the liaison, the church liaison, had written the group a really nice note thanking us for continuing to meet there and basically being partners. They think it's community outreach, and however they perceive it is fine. But he wrote this note, and I said, well, read it to the group when you make your announcements on Wednesday night, secretary announcements. I will. But, of course, just like his sponsor, he has no preparation. He's never even opened the envelope to look at the note. So he's up there, and my gosh, you wouldn't have thought he'd gotten past kindergarten. He's staring at the note, and he says one word, and then he stops, and he says another word, and he stops, and finally he looks at the group, and he says, my gosh, this looks like Thomas Jefferson wrote it. Right? Because it's in cursive writing, and he couldn't read cursive writing. So I don't know what you consider the capacity of a sponsor, but I'm going to tell you, I told him to get a big chief tablet, and I'm going to teach him how to read cursive writing. Anyway, my parents, right? So we live in this big, huge old house. It's got a marker on it. The guy paved streets or some such. And my mother stayed home and ran the house. If you ever seen reruns of Munchies on television, you've seen that big old house. Big old brown brick house, a green tile roof. My dad ran a company that shot seismic. There's a guy here from Hobbs, New Mexico. He'd go all over New Mexico, Oklahoma, different parts of West Texas, looking for the rocks that tell people that there's mailbox money down there, right? And every two or three days, he'd come back home after these two- or three-day trips. And I don't know what your house was like 4 or 5 years of age, but I could not wait for my dad to come home. It seemed like he'd been gone forever. And he'd come in, and he wouldn't come hunt you down. He had a mark in the middle of the two front doors in front of that house, and he'd holler and let you know that he had arrived. And my mother was doing something in the kitchen, and that was supposed to stop. She was supposed to come to the front. I could be in the playroom, tail end, back up at that house. I'm going to tell you, it sounded like he was standing right next to you, and you needed to come. Sometimes, 4 or 5 years old, a little bit mischievous, I'd wait him out and see what he might do. He never come and look for it. He didn't play hide nor seek. He'd go back outside, and he'd slam the door harder, and he'd yell louder. He wanted you to be there. But I'm going to tell you, I bowed one of those steps two at a time. I couldn't hold out. I grabbed him around his legs just as tight as I could possibly hold him, and he'd say, Jimbo, reach in the pocket. He didn't have a jacket. And I'd get in his side coat pocket over here and find the prize. It was an Arrowhead or a Flint Rock or a, you know, Hot Wheels car, something that he found on these amazing travels. I mean, he'd been to Alamogordo, and maybe he'd been, you know, out by Bakersfield. I mean, he'd been to these fabulous places, right? If he missed me really badly, he'd have to get up in his lap and I'd have to get in this inside jacket pocket to find my friends. There were no squealing tires in our driveway. There were no breaking glasses. I don't even remember any loud voices. My mother was a rule maker, and it was real, right? And so we had, I guess, a sense of organization. I guess we had a sense of family, of community, and then one day he stopped off at somebody else's house and never came back home. Happens all the time. I don't remember any deep conversations at 5 years of age to tell me that something had happened that was tearing that house asunder. I don't really remember anybody having any breakdowns around that. It was just like one day he was taking these 2 or 3 day trips and coming home. The next day he just wasn't there anymore. My mother waited a year before she ever even began to think that she would look, you know, for perhaps having some other man in her life. It was a huge deal for her. It mattered her faith. That was a sacrament. It was not to be dissolved or broken. And this guy shows up. They called him a date. I didn't know if it was animal, vegetable, or mineral, but I heard him before I saw him. He had a yellow Ford Fairlane 500 convertible. Had double glass packs on the back of it. I don't mean taupe. I don't mean off-white. I'm talking yellow. This guy was about 6'3". He had lamb chop sideburns, curly black hair. I had on black shirt, black pants, black belt, black 20-toed boots. I'd never seen anything like it. I mean, think about it. My father taught at a university as a service to his community, and he had geology degrees. Exhibit A. Billy Jack showed up at the front door of my house. Exhibit Z. They dumped me off at his mom's house, and I'll speed through that and just tell you within a year they were married. And he segued into the role of husband and father like he'd done it all his life. He's a good man. So we made a family. Got an opportunity a couple years later, moved to Lafayette, Louisiana. My mother was going back to her people. She wasn't a Cajun girl, but she was from the deepest of the deep south. My mother was the kind of person who'd say, oh my gosh, I only came to Dallas to go to school at SMU. I never expected to live my life in the north. And for her, Dallas, Texas is the north. And I ran with a bunch of Cajun kids and had a great year. My grandmother, my stepdad's mom, she flew to Lafayette to turn around, bring the kid up to Dallas for the summer. They were going off doing stuff that adults did. There weren't any laws about any of that 50 years ago. My grandmother got on the plane, my mother got on the plane with us, sat next to us till right before we left, and told me about all the things I was going to do, the places I was going to see. Then right before we took off, she left, and next morning, I was in my grandmother's house, and I mean, phone was ringing off the wall. I smelled breakfast. I knew something was happening. I went downstairs to see what it was, and there were 40 or 50 people in that living room that morning, and everybody quits talking when the 51st person shows up. My grandmother says, your mother's had an accident. We've got to go back to Lafayette. We grabbed some people and some clothes. We go on the next plane, and we flew back down there. We go to the Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital in Lafayette, Louisiana, and small then, that old building's gone. Walkway about half from here back there to the curtains. And they'd leave me in a waiting room in front of that hospital, go down the hallway and go in a room. And you know, I didn't have anything to help me pass the time in 1973. I mean, we didn't have any technology. Maybe flashcards were our technology back then. And if you've been in an old government building that had square ceiling tiles, those acoustic tiles with holes in the tiles, I count the dots in the tiles just to pass the time. And every now and then I look down the hall and somebody pop out of that hospital room and I think they're coming to get me. Because I hold her hand or I whisper in her ear and I can fix it. And 8 or 9 days after we started that process, priest came up the hall, sat down next to me, and gave me a prayer card and said, think good thoughts about your mother. And that's where they let me know that she had passed away. Something or somebody ran her off the road right after she left us at the Lafayette Airport and she didn't survive. The reason that I would share that in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous is not to tell you, look at all these horrible things that happened, and that's why I have a seat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not the whole point. The point is that the main object of the book is to help a guy like me find the power greater than myself. What I can tell you is my mother was the most God-fearing person that I've probably ever known. And I was her only child, and she felt like it was vitally important for her to impart to her boy what it meant to her to surrender to a power greater than herself. And she did that in her building. And what I learned from that experience, nobody told me. What I just knew innately was, oh my gosh, don't you get too close to that power. That power can destroy you. It will destroy you. And it will destroy the lives of people around you that love you unconditionally. I watched it happen. I knew it was happening. And so we closed that house up. I had a real father that was living. Remember the woman that stopped up somewhere else? He didn't make himself known. We had a ranch south of Fort Worth, a big place, a little town called Glen Rose, and my stepdad went down there and moved in with my grandma. He called on the weekends asking how school was going, if I'd hooked up with my old friends. I talked to him for a few minutes, and I think, you know, he should be here with me, because now he's my dad, and he's married to my mother. My grandmother was the youngest of nine children. There were five girls in that family. They all lived these amazing, long lives. And those five sisters talked to each other every day for 75 years. And I'd eavesdrop on their conversations, and she'd say, "It just needs time. His heart is broken because she died so tragically, but that land is going to give him strength. If we leave him on that land, he's going to be okay." So that's what we did. And 11 months after my mother died, our house was full of people. My grandmother was crying so hard she couldn't talk. And my stepfather committed suicide and lived in that ranch house, her only child. And at 9 years of age, I was angry. You know, that is certainly an awkward process at best. But I stuck to her like glue for the course of the next week or 2 weeks, whenever we were going through all the different things that are part and parcel of doing what that is. And I remember, to a man or woman, people would part her company and they'd say, "You know, God doesn't give you more than you can handle." And I remember thinking, "Oh my gosh, they're fools, all of them." They weren't going home with her in that big old house, every light blazing all night, every night, and her laying there crying herself to sleep in the middle of the living room floor. How can you tell me that's benevolence? How can you tell me that that is the gentle hand of anything? So I had this real father that was living. I certainly had godparents. They had herds of kids of their own. So what happened for me is that grandmother, that stepfather's mother, she became the person almost every drunk in the room's got one, who loved me unconditionally, almost to the point of me dying. And I drug her with me all those years later when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Had 14 years of continuous sobriety when she left the earth at the age of 95. The gift of Alcoholics Anonymous, and certainly of a God of my understanding, is we were current. We were current. And the last person that saw her alive besides me was my sponsor, Baxter, who stood with me through that like he'd stood with me through so many other things, right? And I think, what in the world does that have to do with sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous? In my experience, everything. Everything. So I was 15. I was a year younger than everybody else because I'd started school early. I was a freshman at Woodrow Wilson High School in Dallas, Texas. Nerd. 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 I thought, after all these years, that some of that's actually poured away from me. Again, some of the men that I sponsor tell me no such thing, right? I'm a huge Wikipedia. I have Wikipedia'd unbelievable hours since I've been in Southern California. I mean, I know stuff that nobody would ever care about knowing about Ventura, California. Wine's here. So I got these two identical friends. Their dad's a podiatrist. We're a triumvirate of nerds roaming the halls of Woodrow Wilson High School. We found out about a senior beer bus. We didn't know about beer or bus. Now, I've lived alcohol-free zone. Certainly, my parents were young. They had parties. My grandmother drank. But I don't know anything about drinking. And so we went. I don't know what you did at your high school, but we went and we hid and we watched them have the beer bus. And they got in that first keg, and oh my God, it's a place called The Hill at White Rock Lake, which is a little reservoir. It used to be water for the city of Dallas 100 years ago or more. Oh my gosh, they were happy. And when they got in that second keg, it was on. Girls have been chasing boys, and boys have been chasing girls, and that second keg, they started falling down on each other on purpose. And that had never happened on the French Club, or the Science Club, or the Latin Club. So I had two cups of hot foam from a tapped-out keg at the Hill at White Rock Lake. It didn't change my perception that I quit everything they were doing, what they were drinking. Senior leader of the pack found out I had resources. They wanted to avail themselves of my resources. He said, "If you will do the things that we tell you to do, we will teach you how to have a good time." And I want to tell you, they fulfilled that 1,000%. Way back then, 18 was the drinking age in my state. You know, we were the holdout. Like Texas and Louisiana, we held out, right? We stayed 18 until they said no more money of any kind from the federal government. Then we bumped it to 19. And then they said no more money ever from the federal government. Then we went to 21. And the same thing with drinking in the car. When I was driving and drinking all the time, a couple of DWIs, drank in the car. And then they said, oh my gosh, you absolutely cannot drive and have open containers of alcohol in your vehicle. And we said, front seat. So we said, you just couldn't drink, you couldn't have an open container in the front seat. But everybody can have loads of open containers in the back seat. Yeah, we're probably on the academic scale, and that's my home, so I can talk about it on the recording. We are probably not the sharpest knives in the drawer. Right? Anyway, so you could get a hardship driver's license. 18 to drink. I don't know what you did in Southern California, if that's where you grew up, but in Dallas, Texas, she went and saw this old woman and gave her $50, and she made you 18. So I took the driving test, and I passed it. I was really proud about passing the test, but they put a restriction on that license. It said to and from school only. Now, no technology for that either. They just put sticky tape on the back of the regular license. You got a regular driver's license, had sticky tape on the back, said restricted, to and from school only. I'm a senior leader of the pack. I said, I passed the test, but I can't drive at night. Now, remember, he's like 17. He's a world dude, right? He just flips the license over and rips the sticky tape off the back of the license. I mean, I was appalled. So that's an official document. Austin, Texas issues that. It's got a seal on it. You can't malign or defame that. He said, look, dude, this is the way this works. It's 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning. You get pulled over, he's going to run that license. And that cop comes back and says, Mr. Bean, you can't legally operate a motor vehicle in Dallas, Texas this time of night. You look him square in the eyes. It's important. You got to look him square in the eyes. And you say, officer, I had absolutely no idea there was a restriction on my driver's license. I'm going to get data I can't process. I said, if I did that, it'd be a lie. He said, if you lie and they believe it, it's no longer a lie. So the third and final thing I needed was a car to go with the license. And I went home for a fit. There's a lot of fit throwers in this room this morning. We get things we don't need or deserve. I had a brand new Firebird, 14 miles on it when I drove it off the lot. I didn't know where I was going, but I had all the stuff they told me to get. I went through the horseshoe at Woodrow the next day to let everybody know I arrived, and this junior girl saw the car. She didn't see the driver, but she saw the car. I've been in there in the building about 5 minutes, and she found me. Everything was coming true, just like he had predicted, right? My life was changing on a moment-by-moment basis. She gave me an address and picked her up at 7 o'clock. We went to a place called Papagayo Disco in Dallas, Texas, the fall of 1979. We got in that club. Oh, my God. I was 15. I looked like I was about 8 years old. She was 17, had some growth spurts, but she had passed for legal. And they had trays of amaretto sour circulating around that room that night. You paid $1.50. You just pitched it up on the barmaid's tray. Grabbed the drink. They were stacked like two or three high, old-fashioned glasses. I got a drink. They got a drink. I swigged it as quick as I possibly could. Ugh. And I mean, I loved to drink. But that was like cough medicine with ice cubes in it. I said, get another. I picked some money up and got another. Second or third swig. It happened. Oh my God. Where'd that been? I found something that allowed a guy like me to make tomorrow seem like it's a million years away. There's lots of times I need tomorrow to be a million years away. I found something that allowed me to repaint yesterday and make yesterday look exactly the way that I wanted it to look. Over the course of the next 17 years of alcoholic drinking, I'm going to get so good at repainting yesterday that if you're in my periphery, I'm going to make you believe that yesterday looked like that too. Here we go. Here we go. Isn't it fun? We're just having a little bit of fun. I barely got out of high school, right? Freshman nerd, barely got out of high school. I went down the road to SMU, a full academic scholarship. I kept it one whole semester. I got caught for plagiarizing at the university. My grandmother played cards with some women on the board of trustees. She called every favor in the book that day so she could keep me in that school. I didn't tell her thank you for that until almost 20 years later, after I'd come in and gotten sober in AA. Because she owed me. Of course you know she owed me. So I lived my life that way. That first me walking drunk at Papa Guy Disco, I would have told you for the first 10 or 12 years that I drank that it only cost me about 10 bucks to get so me walking drunk and sick. Somebody had to pull me out of that men's room. Somebody else drove my new car home. We all know that's not true. I paid with bits and pieces of my character. You probably did too. I started giving away tools for living from the very first time I got drunk. That is not the average temperate drinker. That's not their journey. That's not their experience. I didn't realize it maybe that first 10 years, but the last 7 I did, and I gladly paid it. I gladly paid it. The desperation's alcoholism, a couple of DWIs, all kinds of public intoxications. It's hard to get a public intoxication in a bar in Texas. I got a little job at a software company. I got a degree with international business in French, like I'm going to use that anywhere ever. I start drinking with adults without supervision. I'm the guy that you get tired of taking care of. I have these unintended consequences of alcoholism. You know, I owe that grandmother, right? I owe her. She sacrificed a large portion of her life. She's not even blood related to me, in order to give me a home and make sure that I'm taken care of. My sponsor would tell you, not in an offensive way, that I was an orphan. And that's true. I didn't have anybody. So, you know, unless she's picking up hot checks or buying me a new car or sending me to Europe, why would I need to call? I don't need to call. We talk a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous about manifestation of selfishness and self-centeredness. I don't call that necessarily a byproduct of alcoholism. I'm just going to tell you it's bad behavior, but the behavior is so bad that I have to drink. A lot of times I forget about the last time I got drunk. So she'd call, I mean, once or twice, about, I don't know, 7 or 7:30 on a Saturday or Sunday morning, and she'd say, I've had the flu, I've tried to get my nieces, I can't get anybody on the telephone, there's a prescription at the drugstore, and I just can't put any clothes on to do it. And I'm not yet taking my first drink of the morning. Now, I stopped probably 2 or 3 o'clock that morning before, but I haven't yet had any hair of the dog. It's coming, but I haven't had it yet. And I know the obligation, I know the debt that I owe. I know that it's just part of natural human kindness, even among strangers, to actually respond to the need by saying yes. And so I do. I called her Bebo. I said, just give me about 15 or 20 minutes. I won't even take a shower. I just need to throw some blue jeans on, and I'll go pick up that prescription. And I make a grave mistake. I just pour 2 or 3 fingers of vodka into a coffee cup. I just need to take a couple of sips, just to kind of line out a little bit before I actually get those clothes on. Then I sit down and I have 2 or 3 fingers more. 15 minutes becomes an hour and a half, 2 hours. She calls back and she says, I am really sick. And we didn't have Uber or Lyft back then. She got no way of actually getting that transported to her. And I said, I just got distracted. I promise you, just give me just another few minutes. I'll put myself together and I'll go get that prescription and bring it on down. Never happens. 2 or 3 hours later, I'm drunk. She talks into an answering machine because I don't even have enough guts to answer my own telephone. She said, honey, you just call me and tell me that you're okay. I promise you, I won't be mad at you. That's not a one-off. It happened all the time. So I got to be good and drunk now to forget about the stuff that I did that I know is not part of normal human character. I am being transformed by the disease of alcoholism. So I got my second DWI in January of 96. I had a wreck like 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It wasn't a big wreck, but my airbags deployed. I went underneath the bumper of a woman in front of me at a stoplight. They came to, you know, all the cops just came almost immediately. Huge intersection. And When they opened my car door to make sure I was okay, I just fell out of the car. They didn't give me a field sobriety test. They said, "What time is it?" And I said, "God, it's got to be about 11 o'clock at night." And he said, "It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon," and they handcuffed me and took me downtown. I prayed to God that day, first time in a long time, get me out. I won't ever let anything like this happen again. Please, please, please. They put me in that drunk tank, and I called my grandmother's lawyer and told him she'd be glad to pay any bill he happened to present me to get me out. He was good. We got downtown. I was half drunk when they let me out of that jail that day. I didn't have two nickels to rub together, but I got in a yellow cab and couldn't afford and went to one of the nicest parts of my city and beat on an 80-year-old woman's door until she came downstairs. When she opened her front door, she couldn't recognize me. Alcoholism changed me fundamentally, physically, certainly emotionally and spiritually. So she tries to preserve what little dignity she might still have and gets me in a side room on a couch 3 or 4 hours later. I start sobering up. I need to go. She said, "I can't give you your keys. You can kill yourself or somebody else." So a 30-year-old man starts tearing up an 80-year-old woman's house. I rip a telephone cord out of the wall and tell her I'll strangle her with the cord if she doesn't give me the keys. That's who came to AA. So when we talk about causes and conditions of the disease of alcoholism, I certainly know that it manifests itself in absolutely every area of my life. I know that I chased it almost to the gates of insanity and death. And there were many, many things that I left along the way, and one of the things that I left along the way was the ability to try to quietly sit and listen and appreciate God's grand plan and design. And that was all given back to me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because as with me, when I was new, oftentimes I find that people sometimes new or not so new in the rooms of AA have absolutely no idea how much God is doing for them that they cannot do for themselves. And most often, I only recognize after the fact, not at the time when it's actually occurred. So that probation officer, of course, turning the heat up on me, I get revised conditions here and there and everywhere, and you know, I just feel like another bad hand of cards been dealt, right? May of 1997, I was called in the PO's office right before Memorial Day. She said, "Mr. Dean," she was happy. First time she'd been happy in a year. She's giddy. She said, "Mr. Dean, I'm going to have you arrested right here in the office. I've sent your file to the court. They've already sent the letter back that came this morning. That's why I called you. I needed you to come right away. Do you think you're alcoholic?" The very first time I said, "I don't know." I had never even remotely thought about the A word. And I didn't know, again, until after the fact, but that kept me out of state jail for 2 years for revocation and probation. Just the simple answer, the unconditioned answer. And so I found myself in this outpatient treatment facility that Memorial Day of 1997. They tricked us. Right before 6 o'clock, they marched us like lemmings around the corner of some discussion meeting in my city. I don't know what they talked about. I have no idea about topic or substance. I can tell you that I did some simple math. I didn't know AA meetings lasted an hour. There were about 50 people in that room, and I thought, my God, if every one of these people talk, we're going to be in here all night long. So, silver chips, the recycled beer cans, 24-hour commitment to sobriety, they offered it, and I grabbed it. I mean, I jumped up and ran to the front. Now, there was no commitment behind that for me. I just needed to stop the madness. And it worked. We prayed, and a couple of minutes after 7, everybody was gone. The room was empty. And that's okay. I found a couple of things just in my experience as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a member of home group. One of the things that I've learned that has served me well is there's a huge difference between going to Alcoholics Anonymous and being in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's all right. But I do believe, based on my own experience, that we really do get based on what we pay in. And I'm glad that there was one guy who had 6 months of sobriety and had really good sponsorship. You can't say anything, I can't say anything negative about sponsorship. And he had been told that if there was a new man in that meeting, that he needed to make sure that he pressed his flesh. And so that's what he did that day. He approached the new man. I was in a coat and tie. He was covered in drywall. He had 30 earrings in this ear and 35 earrings in this one. He had tattoos starting at the top of his neck, and they ran to the tips of his fingernails. It was a godsend to the new man in AA. And he looked me square in the eyes and a firm handshake, and he said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to AA." He was excited about that. He tried to get my phone number. I was having none of that. He gave me a phone number and told me that if I needed it for any reason, I should use it as a resource, and asked me if I'd be at that same meeting tomorrow night. He even asked me if I was part of a little group of herd of people, quacks, that had come over from the treatment center. Nothing. I didn't call him that night, but I showed up at that meeting that next day. About the middle of June, I was dying of alcoholism in the treatment center. It's bad. So no group any better or worse, but they shipped me out on Thursday night because they actually read the book. And they didn't, you know, just our topics, I think, were just kind of flying out of this thing they called the Daily Reflections. They just grabbed the Daily Reflections. Now, I was delegate. This is a tangent deal. I'll only take a minute. I know Daily Reflections is a great reader. We had a woman named Eleanor Wood, an AA member in New York at the publishing, over the publishing department when I was delegate. We had a proposal for Daily Reflections Part 2. Because there were a lot of groups, obviously, that had used the topics over and over and over. I get it. We wanted some additional resources, you know, one day at a time. So we asked Eleanor to come give us the history of the original Daily Reflections. And she said, you know, she'd been sober about 40 years. She said, you know, when Alcoholics Anonymous does anything in response to anything outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, it normally doesn't work real well for us. And so the 24-hour day book had come, and it had been offered to us to publish, and we had declined because it didn't source in AA. At least that's the story that I understand. And so we decided we'd just go write our own. So we asked the fellowship, we do it all the time, please make some submissions. There's 365 days in a year. Make some submissions, and publishing's going to go through all these piles. And she said, we had three piles. We had the, oh my gosh, this is great pile. We had the, this'll do pile. And we had the ain't no way pile. And she said, by the time we got to July, we were well into the ain't no way pile. So anyway, we didn't do the Daily Reflections Part 2. But anyway, they studied the book. So I thought the meeting started at 6. My meeting with this yahoo, this big tall guy that looks like Larry Bird, was at 6. The AA meeting didn't start until 8. We sat on this concrete picnic table outside of the Grace Bible Church in Dallas, Texas, where this AA, this rogue AA group met. And I mean, he put a healing on me that night. It was like a symphony. Have you ever been to a symphony where you just, where they kind of teach you about how they're going to blend all that mess together? We used to take some kids to the Meyerson in Dallas after I got sober and show them kind of concerts and stuff. The same kind of deal. So, I mean, he started like there's just one string on a violin, and then he started bringing some brass in there. We had some percussion and drums. And I'm going to tell you, there's a saying in my part of the world, if we had cut his suspenders, he would have just flown straight up, right? I mean, he was on fire for AA. And he brought me in, and they studied the book. They were talking about the 10th or the 11th step. And after we got done, we went to somewhere for a hamburger, and then they went over to some JoJo's for pie, and this, that, and the other thing. And I mean, by the end of the evening, I realized that I had been exposed. I had given of my valuable time, probably 7 hours, for what was supposed to be a 1 hour meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got drunk. I mean, you're worn out. 7 hours in AA, you need a drink. They gave me my first commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is Sunday morning. It's supposed to be the spiritual part of the morning. So I can tell you, I understand absolutely the spiritual context of service in Alcoholics Anonymous because of what that first group did for me. I put the signs out. Let people know that AA met inside. I put the steps and traditions inside the room where we had that little book study, 20 or 25 of us. Now, the big group of Alcoholics Anonymous didn't think the window shades were good enough, so they had formed a subcommittee. Anybody in AA in this room familiar with committees in Alcoholics Anonymous? So we formed this subcommittee on the window shades. And we're not about moderation, even though we're sober. And so they had these double oak frames, and I swear bulletproof glass put around these window shades. You'd think that they were precious items, right? And so when we got them back, we realized they weighed about 85 pounds apiece, and there were only about two AA members that were bulky enough to be able to handle them. So then we had to form the second subcommittee, which was the portability of the newly framed window shades committee. And we put dolly wheels on them, so I dolly wheeled them into the room. That was my job. Every week until the 25th of August of 97, from the middle of June, I drank Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I didn't drink all day Thursday. Didn't realize it at the time. I showed up 30 minutes before that AA meeting started, and I went to the closet to get those stick signs to put out in the yard of the group. I mean, at the church. One of the members of the steering committee would follow me out. Jimmy, we understand you've lost your sobriety. We're going to have to relieve you of your commitment. Then it'd take them, I don't know, about 20 or 30 seconds. They'd spin on a heel and they'd come and give the commitment back. So it was a three legacy group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We've read the traditions in every single meeting I've been in over the course of the weekend, and I want to thank the committee for doing that. They knew that the common welfare came first, but I was in a home group. I was in a meeting house. My sponsor was talking about me behind my back, and he said, I don't understand it, but the only sober breath that he draws is when he comes to put the signs out on Thursday, and they encouraged that. They did not make sacrifices just for me individually, but oh my gosh, they saved my life. So the going to healing's part, and I know it's about time for us to all free up here. I wasn't welcome in my grandmother's home when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. She was afraid of me, rightly so. So I started reading the book with that sponsor once I got sober. It wasn't a good day or a bad day. I just reconciled on the night of the 24th of August. I finally realized that what you were telling me about God doing for you what you couldn't do for yourself, I knew that you believed that. And that flimsy read was enough for me to get started. And so I asked that sponsor, that tall Larry Bird guy, what we needed to do next. And he said, you need to start reading the book. And so the way we did it is rather than read together, what I do with the guys that I sponsor, he told me to read two pages, and we talked about the two pages. And he could tell that I am not inclined to surrender to anything. I'm not atheist, nor am I agnostic. I bristle at that as well. I just call myself disinterested. So we spent a lot of time talking about various experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous that he believes all of them are of the spiritual variety, and I would not necessarily contradict. I mean, I have always been respectful. There are only two or three things we can attach always to in 26 years, but I've always been respectful. Because both of those men that I've called sponsor, Greg the first 2 years and Baxter the last 25, they've given up their time freely. They've engaged in that relationship at my request, and I believe that there's some conditions around that, right? I don't know where that comes from, but it's here, right? So we read the two pages of the book, and we get on into that part. You know, I can get the alcoholism part. I understand it. I understand about sense of ease and comfort. I understand about knowing what you're going to get just driving to the liquor store. I get all of that part. And then we're going to edge on into that second step, and I'm reading those two pages, and we're talking lots and lots of windshield time. Seems like he was on what I call the chicken circuit back then. He was talking at every little group, within 50 miles of us. And you know, it'd be one of those things like, oh God, what are we doing on Thursday night, right? And so we talk on the way to the meeting, we talk on the way back. What happened? So we met, parted for company after dinner on Saturday night. It was an open speaker meeting. And when we were parting company in about, I don't know, I've been sober about 40 days, he said, you haven't talked to your grandmother. And I said, yeah, and I think over a year. And he said, tomorrow's Sunday, and I want you to call her tomorrow. And you call her every Sunday until she tells you, do not call me anymore. And I got in the car, and I knew the definition of beyond any links. I'm not doing that. I got no tools for that. Mm-mm. No. But I drove home, and I made a grave mistake. For those 40 days that I've been continuously sober, approaching the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, there were some simple things that he told me he did every single day, and he strongly suggested that I do as well. So before I went to bed that night, I hit my knees and I thanked God for a day of sobriety, a God that I did not know nor understand. And I slept all night long. I didn't toss and turn or wonder about any of that. The next morning, before I could catch myself, I started the day as I had done for the past 40 days. I hit my knees and I asked God that I did not know nor understand for a day of sobriety. And I couldn't think about anything but the phone. I continued to hear the direction that I had been given. I made the call. Short, terse, no emotion. It was worse than I had even imagined that it could possibly be. But I made the call. And then I called and whined about that with my sponsor over the course of the next 7 days. He said, did she tell you, do not call me again? And I said, no. And he said, next Sunday. And I continued to take the action, believing nothing. I'd been sober about 7 months. I was on step 1.75. And at 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning, she answered the telephone and she said, I've been thinking about you today. I made this batch of tuna salad. When you were a little boy, you loved my tuna salad. You can be at my house in the next 30 minutes. I'll make you a tuna salad sandwich. I ran red lights to get down to her house. And I ate that sandwich that morning in her breakfast room. And true to form, at 11:30, she kicked me to the curb. I rushed back out to my house because I didn't have a cell phone back then, 1998. I called Greg, and as soon as he picked up the phone, I said, oh my God, she's changed. He said, no, Jimmy, she hasn't changed, nor does she need to. You are just beginning to exhibit natural byproduct of beginning to try to apply the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in your life. There are certain things that you cannot postpone, nor can you evade. There will be principles, fundamental aspects of your character that will be a byproduct of participating with and trying to the best of your ability to leave AA better than you found it. Those four things are accountability, availability, responsibility, and respectability. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me those things. They are spiritual tools. Anything and everything that I've had the opportunity to do as a participant in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I see God's hand in all of those things. I am not nearly as concerned today, with just a little bit of time in the program, about whether or not you see those things for what I absolutely know they really are. Because I know that if you stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's absolutely no way that you can postpone, nor can you evade the hand of whatever that God, as you define that God, or that power, or not that power, even if the power is absolutely no power at all. Because believing in nothing is believing in something. And that's who we are, and that's what we're all about. So I thank you for the opportunity to spend the weekend in sunny Southern California. And if you're ever in my town, Wednesday night, 7 o'clock, we would love to see you. Thanks.